So interestingly, I've been navigating this world of infinite inputs. How many of you guys feel like there's too many things to do, too many options, too many supplements, not sure which ones to take, not sure which workouts to do? Does that feel like a common challenge you guys ever experience? Like, what the hell do I do with my time? I only have so many hours and minutes in the day, and I'm not really sure how to navigate them. Anyone else feel like that?
Yep.
Little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's not uncommon. And so I thought today I would take some time to navigate that with you guys, help you guys to understand how I think about it and why everyone must been repeatedly beating his head against the wall, must have unique approaches. So here's the way I encourage you to think about this. So everyone's certainly genetics are different. Everyone's lifestyle and history are different. Everyone's environment is different. And your genetics plus your lifestyle and history up to this point in your life have created this internal reality, right? We've created this internal psychological reality and this internal physiological reality, neck down and neck up, right? So neck down, and they're not separate, but for the point of this discussion, it's useful to think about this. So neck down, I have this biochemical reality, right? I have this soup, this mix of all these hormones and molecules and inflammation and all these different things that exist in my body, nutrients and insulin and carbs and fats, and they're all just like rumbling around together, and they're creating an expressed version of you, an expression of you, right? So what does that mean, an expression of me? Well, we're born with genes, and based on these inputs, this soup, the body's going to express certain genes in response to the environment, its internal environment, to make you more prepared for what's around you. So, for example, if I'm in a house, which I literally think I am right now, a house with mold, my body's going to upregulate my mold detoxification pathways, and those genes for detoxification are going to be working harder. And if I stay in this house long, then those genes will continue to work hard, and that will literally change my body, right? That may drive more oxidative stress, that may drive accelerated aging, that may drive liver toxicity, it may drive immune function. But my body is constantly adapting to my internal and my external environment. Always. Doesn't stop. From the time you were born, in fact, from before you were born to right now, your body is constantly trying to make you better suited to be effective in the world. That's what our bodies do. That's what literally genes are doing at all times. Genes are either turning on or they're not turning on based on the response to our current inputs. So inputs can be the way there's only six inputs, relatively simple. There's the way I move, the way I eat, the way I breathe, the way I think, the way I sleep, and the environment in which I do it. Those are the only six inputs. There's only six inputs in the human system. So it simplifies it. You're like, okay, well, all those inputs are creating some type of internal reality. And my body's adapting to make me more effective at the reality. Boom. So, for example, if you, when you were in utero in your mom's belly, you were around a lot of stress. Let's say you grew up in war-torn Europe. Your mom was bathing in stress. You too were bathing in stress. Your body would turn on these genes to make you better suited at dealing with stress as soon as you're born. If you were born in Siberia, your body would be better at dealing with cold, just because of the expression of these genes when you're in utero. So it's no different then than it is now. So why is this important? To understand what inputs are most useful for you today, you must understand what's happening in that internal soup, right? And so sometimes our symptoms can lead the path. The symptoms can be like, oh, that symptom generally means this, meaning like I got low energy, symptom. I have high body fat, symptom. I have poor sleep, symptom. Those are not interventions, those are symptoms, right? Those are like, oh yeah, I have low energy. That's a symptom. Yeah. So it's a symptom of what? Symptom of something maybe going on inside of your body. The body's not able to keep up with the demands of your life. The body is simply doing the best it can. It's speeding along the best it can to keep up with the demands you are placing on it, right? And those demands are sometimes conscious and sometimes unconscious. So the conscious demands are, hey, I need to go and do this exercise. Unconscious demand, or I'm going to go hang with my partner, or whatever. Unconscious demands are the environment you're breathing, the the things that are happening around you constantly. The light is some type of stimulus. The air quality, the food you consume. These are some of the inputs that ultimately determine your outputs, ultimately determine your outcomes. So in order for you to understand which levers are most important for you now, remembering, I'll give you a framework, that there's three things to think about, right? So there's, well, maybe the precursor to those three is I want to sort of understand somehow what's happening inside of my body. None of you guys that I know of are exercise professionals or health professionals or medical professionals. So the job of a health professional, medical professional, exercise professional is to start to understand when I see a symptom on the outside, that leaves clues that something like this may be happening on the outside. Example, I've had gas, diarrhea, and bloating for 6 months. Chances are something's not so good in your stomach. I've got low energy. Chances are something's not so good with respect to mitochondria. I've been sleeping poorly. Chances are something's not so good in your nervous system. So we ultimately, as coaches, as experts, see symptoms, and it leaves clues to lead us go, I think it's probably this. Do we know for sure? No. How do we learn for sure? We test. So what do we test? All of you guys, when you started coaching with us, you went through some version of testing, right? There's genetic testing, which is incredibly important. There's epigenetic testing, which is incredibly important. There's extensive blood testing. There's urine analysis. There's stool analysis. And there's hair and saliva analysis. So all of those are potential useful ways for us to get an idea of what's happening inside your body. And once we understand what's happening inside of your body, it's basically looking at which of these markers is furthest away, most diverted away from where we want it to be. Like, that's not in a good spot. That's way over there. We got to bring that guy back, because that's generally a symptom of something not good happening. So while we can assess symptoms, we can also measure objective internal markers. Then we can start to identify, okay, well, here's our current limitations. Our limiters are, hey, this guy doesn't produce energy well. This person's got too much cortisol and adrenaline. This person's got too much insulin and glucose. We can start to see what's happening inside the body, and we start to formulate a plan based on what? Based on the things that are furthest away from this foundational ideal, this place where we want to be, right? So this is, remember, this is step one. This is what we call phase one. So phase one is bringing your body back into the ideal homeostasis. Homeostasis is this ideal steady state, phase one, right? So phase one is, I jokingly say, it's kill the alligator closest to the boat. It's, oh man, I'm not sleeping well, I'm not digesting well, my energy's crappy, my brain fog is abundant. Phase one, fix all of those things. Not all levers are going to work for all people. Do you need all longevity modalities? No. If your gut is dysfunctional, your sleep is messed up, your stress, your and et cetera, et cetera, you don't need glycine and N-acetylcysteine for longevity. You certainly don't need metformin for longevity. You got to fix the foundational things first. You have to bring your body back into this homeostatic place before peptides, supplements, and pills, powders, and potions do anything useful for you. Okay, so phase one, which we all must go through at least once a year, in my opinion, is assessing your blood, your urine, your stool, maybe your epigenetics, to see like, hey, where am I getting off track here? Because we're never thrown off track, we're always nudged off track, right? So that's phase one. What is going to be most effective for you in phase one for supplements, for peptides, for interventions? Answer, we don't know. We can guess. And generally, most people look for online is a general consensus that if I take this thing, it might do something useful for me. That's what how most people make their decisions. Hey, I trust this guy or this girl. She said this thing's useful, therefore it must be useful. And the answer is it might be useful, but in varying amounts for all people, right? So we can't definitively say that all supplements are gonna do all the same thing to all people. That's unequivocally not accurate, because there's a lot of different factors, genetics, environment, lifestyle, primarily, and internal biochemical reality. So I'm gonna pause there. And so I'm also gonna talk about what I call phase two, which is performance. So phase one is like, hey, let's bring you into this homeostatic place. And often it's like creating some semblance of harmony. I use the word harmony in the body. What does harmony mean? It means living in harmony with your genes, your environment, and your lifestyle. Harmony. So as an example, if I have really poor inflammatory genes and I'm smashing inflammatory foods, you're going to be out of harmony. If you have amazing inflammatory genes, then you could be inflamed and your body's probably going to be, it's going to take longer for that negative thing to take effect, as an example. Maybe you have amazing deep genes for carbohydrate metabolism, which ironically many people do, but over and they can get away with huge amounts of carbs up to a certain point, and all of a sudden that breaks and the cells stop functioning well, and now we got to fix the problem. And this is why most people can make it through their first 40 years of life not really having to fix anything. You're generally pretty good up until you're 35, right? After 35, you're like, oh shit, all that dumb stuff I did in my 20s, it's catching up to me now. So I'm going to pause, and I'm talking a lot, and ask any questions or answer any questions or comments you guys have about what we talked about at this point. Jeff, what's up, man? I saw you pop in there. Jake, any questions from you?
No, I'm good. Thanks, sir. Appreciate it.
So I know that doesn't answer questions.
So, go ahead, man. Sorry, Ben. I got a quick question for you. So all the technology that we have access to today, from the smartwatches that are kind of monitoring all that stuff and the blood tests you can get and the gene testing. And like, I feel like we're kind of on the cusp of, we're on the edge of science, right? In terms of saying, hey, these peptides can do these things. We can kind of get down to the cellular level. And some of that is, it's a little bit hard to decipher. I mean, when I originally came to this program, it was like nutrition is like this black box, like eggs are good, no eggs are bad. Like, and I feel like there's a lot of, information out there about, you know, TRT and peptides and stem cells, and like, how do you decipher what's real and what's not? I mean, what are you leveraging in terms of either scientific studies or some type of data set that says this is real and this is something that is useful, as opposed to, you know, snake oil salesman type things? Yeah. That makes sense.
So yeah, of course. So the first thing you do is you identify the obstacle or the challenge, right? So what's my limiter? Like, what am I trying to fix? And then what I do is I look at all the potential levers that I could potentially pull for this thing. So Bill, for example, let's say you're like, hey man, I'm trying to put on 20 pounds of muscle. I'm like, great. That's something that's a goal. That's maybe a limiter. Like, what are all the things we could potentially do? So we could put testosterone on that list. We could put growth hormone on that list. We could put protein on that list. We could put creatine on that list. There's this really long list of effective training. There's a whole lot of list of things. And then we look at, well, there's always some level of confidence in the intervention. So we're always going to look at, well, what's our current level of confidence in this intervention? And if you're like, well, I know that creatine training, protein, and great sleep works, so let's do those ones first. And if we can do those ones and you're still not getting the result, then we're like, well, which one is sort of further out the risk curve? You know, you're like, okay, well, we know those four work and he's doing them really well. He got all those nailed. What's the next fifth and sixth on the list? And you're like, huh, well, maybe Bill is someone who needs some testosterone. So let's have that measured. And let's go, well, okay, Bill, your testosterone's pretty low. If you wanted to put on 20 pounds of muscle, maybe we could bump it up a little. So we really start with like, which ones have the greatest amount of scientific backing and the greatest amount of historical backing? Like, hey, these actually work. And we implement those first. We're like, hey, we know these work. And if they don't work, then we're like, okay, let's just try a little further out the risk curve. So, and how far you want to go out the risk curve is completely a personal thing. Like, I generally go pretty far out the risk curve because I always feel like I should be the canary in the coal mine, right? I'm flying to Switzerland to do experimental modalities in longevity because I want to be able to come back to you guys and be like, hey, this is what I did, this is what happened, and here's what I measured. So, you know, last year I flew to Costa Rica, this year I flew to Switzerland, I'm going back to Switzerland again, going to Dubai, doing a bunch of really experimental things to see like, hey, what actually works and what doesn't work. I'm willing to put my money where my mouth is so that I can be at the tip of the spear for you guys, and not just speak from someone else's experience, but also speak from my own. So, well, that's the way I think about it. It's like some things we know work. So the way you think of it is, how big of a lever is it? And what's your likelihood of adherence? So if I say to you, hey man, if you want to put on 20 pounds of fat, I need you to train 3 hours a day, excuse me, 20 pounds of muscle, your adherence is less. So we have to always weigh this, like, how big of a lever is it? And how likely are you to stick with it? So like with muscle building, protein's a big lever. Not everyone's willing to do it, but if you are, it's a pretty big lever. Does that make sense? Do you have a specific topic you want to wrap on?
No, I think that made sense to me.
Okay. Yeah. So the way, man, that's one of the benefits of having done this for 25 years is there's probably not an intervention that I'm not familiar with. And then I go, okay, well, here's all the potential things we could do for this specific goal you're trying to achieve. Here's the ones I know are useful. And here's the ones I'm like, that might be useful for this person, but it's not useful for this person, right? Because you can generally see there's other things that confound to be like, hey, which problem are we actually trying to solve here? For example, and give you the best example, Bill, when you started here, you said that nutrition was a black box. And I literally said earlier today jokingly, and this is sort of joking, sort of not, that nutrition is a 1.5 page textbook, 1.5 pages. If you want to understand actual nutrition, in my mind, it's 1.5 pages that I wrote. And like, I don't think it's perfect, but I think if you understood that and did nothing outside of that 1.5 pages, you would have unbelievable success when it comes to nutrition. And you're like, how is nutrition 1.5 pages? Because nutrition is not about what goes, it's not about knowledge, it's about what goes into your mouth. Which is not about information, it's about behavior. So then we have to start looking at what's driving your behavior, right? So most people know that they should be eating broccoli, chicken, and sweet potatoes, but they eat something different than that because they're trying to solve a different problem. They're generally trying to solve an energy problem or a focus problem or a motivation problem or an anxiety problem or an environmental problem, but it's not about nutrition. And I think that's where I sort of go the opposite direction that most people do when it comes to nutrition. Anyone else have questions before I keep wrapping? So let me throw this at you, Mike. What occupies your mind right now as far as should I be taking this or this? Is there anything that's top of mind for you right now that you're like, oh, I wonder which one's a bigger lever? Small groups, I'm gonna pick on you, Mike.
Yeah. Right now, seeing as I got my genes tested, I've been trying to see which is the best route to go in terms of, say, higher carbs, less fat, and I'm just trying to land somewhere in between because I haven't made sense of it all yet.
Man, I think the answer is it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So this is actually a really good segue into what we're gonna talk about next. Mm-hmm. So in a foundational base way, meaning like for 98% of the people in the world, it doesn't matter at all. Where it starts to matter is when performance is the variable you're trying to solve for. So when performance looks like, hey, I'm trying to add muscle, I'm trying to perform well as an athlete, I'm trying to do something exceptional with my body, now the type of fuel matters and the timing of the fuel matters. But as a foundational level, the type and timing don't matter at all. For most people, it's like, just get it in, hit the calories, get your protein in, get your fiber, carbs and fats can sort of come from wherever. If I wanted to like, hey, I'm actually trying to get my body to perform well, I would give myself a minimum 6-month time horizon, minimum, probably closer to 12, and say, here's the thing I'm trying to do specifically, because you're asking for an adaptation in your body. So for example, if you're trying to decide between carbs and fats, the answer is whatever you've done up to this point will likely mean that's probably what you're going to be best at. So if you did the next 6 months of a low carb, high fat diet, that's probably going to feel pretty good for you for the most part. If you're coming from the other direction, higher carb, lower fat, it's probably going to feel a little bit better. Why? Because your body becomes used to using whatever fuel it has. So your body's like, yeah, I generally have a lot of carbohydrates. I can become better at glycolysis. I'm going to drive this system. So learning to swing your nutrition is generally, it shouldn't be a decision based on short-term goals. It should be a decision based on long-term goals and long-term lifestyle. So if you're like, hey man, I kind of like eating carbohydrates, I'd rather include some of those in my life, then you gotta do it. If you're like, hey, I hate carbohydrates, I don't want to ever have to eat them, or I know that I can't control myself, then we take them out and we use fats. But neither one is uniquely important or necessary. Except when it comes to driving performance. Now, within that, the type of carb and the type of fat can matter. Certainly the type of fat matters, the type of carb matters less, but the type of fat absolutely matters in the type of outcome you're going to achieve. For example, you have to have a balance of omega-3, 6, and 9. None of them are bad, none of them are devils. They're all important in creating, because they all have certain metabolic processes that are required in the body. So anyone that tells you omega-6 is bad is wrong. However, omega-6, generally the way we consume it in the standard American diet, is highly processed foods that also come with additional solvents and toxins that are not good for anyone. Make sense, Mike?
Does make sense, yeah. When I was thinking too when you were speaking earlier, I was thinking, you know what, training feels good, you know, appetite feels good, the diet's good, everything's pretty solid. And I was thinking what would be a good kind of place to start to bring awareness to maybe where you're deficient or what might need some attention. Like
Yeah, push the gas pedal down harder.
yeah. Okay.
Oh, no, like that's the answer, right? So how do I bring awareness to where what needs more attention? Push the gas pedal down harder and find out what breaks. So like if you want to know how you should be what the limiter is in your system, push the system. Like if you're driving a good car and you push that car to the limit, you're going to know real fast what breaks. Your body's no
Right.
different, right? So if you're like, everything feels pretty good. Well, bring in a training partner for a couple of days a week who actually pushes you to a new limit and see what happens. You're like, oh man, I'm really sore. I need more protein. There's your answer. You're like, oh man, I don't have enough gas pedal for this workout. He's kicking my ass. I need more carbohydrates. I need more glycolytic pathway. So you, by pushing the engine harder, you learn what the limiter is, what the bottleneck is.
That's all. That makes sense.
Yeah, that and that most people are afraid of doing that. Or first of all, they're not capable. Because like mentally and physically they just can't do it. And that's a whole different, I would love to talk about that with you guys, like understanding where to push and how to push and how to create a body that can push. Like that's the goal, right? Is I want a body that when I need something from it or when I want something from it, it's there. It's not like, oh shit, I'm not sure if I'm gonna be able to run or I'm not sure if I'm gonna be able to lift. Like that to me is broken. Like if you're under 75 and you're limited by your body, we got problems. Let's fix it. Right? If you're over 75, you're like, yeah, my knee kind of hurts. Like, okay, great. If you're under 75, you better fix it.
Right.
No, not saying you, but one, you
Yeah,
know.
yeah, yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome.
Hey, Ben, if
Jeff,
you don't mind,
go ahead, Jake.
what are your thoughts on like carb? I mean, kind of going on carbs. Yeah, I don't mean to drag this out too much, but carb cycling, you know, if you have maybe on rest days per se, or just like a no carb days versus higher carb days, or that kind of thing. And is that something that's really gonna push the wheel? I just came on with the off the I'm fresh
Yeah,
out
no,
of
perfect.
the gate here,
Yeah.
so anyway.
So what's your number one goal?
Yeah, it's definitely fat loss right now.
You
And
have a specific
get to
number?
15% body fat's where is where I'm going aiming for right now. Yeah.
Yep.
That's
And
the number
so
one.
what how what's your current body weight?
210.
210. What do you want to be?
Out 180, well, eventually 170. Within the year, 170 is where I want to be.
Okay, so let's say we want to drop 40 pounds, and the primary goal is fat loss. So,
Primary goal's fat
do
loss.
you think?
Secondary would be 15 pounds or more muscle. That's,
Got it.
yeah.
So the question then becomes, well, how does carbohydrate play into my ability to lose fat and play muscle? So we know the question we're trying to solve, right? The problem we're trying to
Yeah.
solve for is how does carbohydrate play into my ability to lose fat and gain muscle? More specifically, how does carbohydrate cycling play into my ability to lose fat and build muscle? So, I would say your primary goal should be to teach your body how to use fat for fuel more effectively, right? We want our body to, at rest, be really good at burning fat. And the way it's actually a pretty simple, measurable thing. It's like, well, how do we increase lipolysis, right? So, a little lipolysis is the
Yeah,
ability to
yeah.
take fat from the cell, you know.
Yep.
And so, well,
Gotcha.
we got to make sure glucose and insulin levels are down. Step one, right? We probably want to make sure that our body isn't chronically in an elevated stress state. So that may mean, so those are sort of two separate, while interrelated, you know, glucose and insulin should probably be somewhat low, you know, always. You know, it can obviously go up, but we don't want to have it chronically elevated because that will obviously drive fat storage. And then we want to make sure
Yes,
we're not
of
overly
course.
stressed. And then we have to make sure our body's actually oxidizing the fat that we put into the bloodstream. So we sort of have these multiple steps. And I'd say those are the three things you're solving for first. So we have three interventions. It's one, manage glucose and insulin, two, manage stress, and three, make sure you're moving enough to oxidize the fat. So oxidizing the fat that's in the bloodstream requires movement, right? Or you obviously being in a slight caloric deficit and then movement. So you have three interventions right there. And in my mind, in the short term, your sort of goal to build muscle can be fueled off what you've got stored currently. Like you probably aren't going to be awesome at generating huge amounts of intensity in the gym. I could be wrong, but that wouldn't be the first priority. I would get your body metabolizing fat more effectively first. So think of like fat and carbs as different energy systems. So we want
Yeah.
a body to be really useful at using fat for fuel now. And then once we're losing some fat, then we can drive glycolysis more effectively in the gym only. So if you were to drive glycolysis in the gym, the only time that I'd be taking carbohydrate is either right before or right during. That's it. So you,
Not
because you
after necessarily. Okay.
no, you don't need it now. I mean, if you live in a chronically stressed state, then maybe we'd put a little in before bed, like with dinner, to sort of bring
I
down
have
the
heard of.
cortisol. But after your workout is less important. I don't need you to replenish glycogen after a workout. I need you to sleep well. I need you to train hard. Those are more important. I put in 30 to 50 grams in the workout, 30 to 50 grams before bed. That's kind of all you need. Now, could you do a higher carbohydrate diet to lose fat? Yes, but let's say in the beginning, it's going to be slower if your insulin levels are going like this, because it's generally for most people they have a hard time controlling appetite that way. So by controlling insulin, you control appetite.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate
Yeah. Someone else had a question. Jeff, yourself?
Yeah, I think kind of some of the stuff that you've had on the podcast recently is of interest. In particular, one of my goals for the program was not just the physical, but using the physical as a key to unlock more mental clarity through the day. So use that hour of workout to be as intense and focused on that as possible, and that yields its own gains that way. But then translate that to in my day when I'm working, now I can not worry about that. I'm focused on the thing I have to do next at work. And to that end, you've had Dr. Scherr on your show,
Scott.
and then talking with Jay Campbell about peptides and methylene blue. So those kind of two areas, things that I think you don't get a lot of like mainstream, providers. I work in the medical field, so you don't see a lot of mainstream providers saying like, "Well, we'll get you on," aside from the GLP class of medications. Saying, hey, you should be taking this plus this, and then take this pack of methylene blue to optimize your energy systems and stuff. So that was kind of interesting to me, in terms of focus, in terms of recovery, and then knowing someone with a pretty significant TBI where like they still get headaches and have dizziness and stuff like that. Maybe some of the applications to something like that.
Okay, so let's unpack this one at a time. First thing, let's talk about your training and how you're going to take that, maximize the training effect, and transfer that into your life. So the thing that you're after is autonomic control. So we need to understand what autonomic arousal is and autonomic control is. So when you get into the hardest, heaviest set of your day, your brain, your nervous system, your adrenals, they're spilling everything into the blood and going, we've got to get all hands on deck. We're trying to generate as much output, as much violence, as much aggression as we possibly can in this one set. Everything's got to go. That's the greatest level of arousal that we have as humans, right? And so it's like some version of fighting, run, sprinting, lifting. Like those are all like peak masculine arousal. And the other side of that is the meditative state. It's like, how can I get myself into the most calm state of almost no arousal? So the heart rate slows, the breathing rate slows, the brain function slows down, the electrical impulses slow down. And so think of those as like the opposite ends of the spectrum. I literally call it the warrior and the monk. And the more you can learn to tune that system intentionally, the more effectively you can access it during the day. So if I, and so I'll say this. By depending on substances, and I'm not against them, but hear me out. By depending on substances can lock you in one state. So I can be in a constantly sympathetic state, which means for some short amount of time, I'm going to be ultra focused. But the problem with that is generally what happens when I get locked in that state, I also don't have the equal and opposite downside. So what we need to do as men, the ideal circumstance is I can access the warrior and I can access the monk at will, one breath. And that's the ideal circumstance, right? So when we can, you can use training on purpose to train that. And I highly suggest you do it, literally every day. Like, what does it look like to get from this peak crazy state of arousal to, like, can I get to where my heart rate is barely elevated? So, an example, if I could get to 180, 190 beats per minute doing a sprint or doing a set of squats or leg press, how long does it take me to get down under 100? There's a good test. So you think of, like, literally, being a medicine guy, you'll get like the area under the curve, right? So, like, if it's a slow decline, it's a bigger area under the curve. Your objective is to minimize the area under the curve. You want to have the ability to come down on more of a vertical horizon and get out of that sympathetic state as quickly as possible. And then you have the ability to control and toggle within those states based on what you need. And so where people run into problems, if they get stuck in one state or the other, or they don't have the ability to transition between those states. So that this states are literal, like, brain states, right? So you got gamma, beta, alpha, theta, delta brain waves. So we want to learn to curate those. And so we can curate them with, certainly in the gym, you're going to have high beta, but then how quickly can I get myself out of beta into an alpha state? Like, can you do that? And the answer is yes, but most people don't train it. So this would be something that, like, a high-level Navy SEAL would be training, right? Like, why do they want to be in an alpha state? Because if they're trying to put a bullet between somebody's eyes, they can't be breathing heavy and panicking, right? So they got to be like quickly bang, right? And so that's literally the ultimate expression of peak mental capability, which is obviously very closely tied with peak physical capability. So the things I would train in yourself, Jeff, is like get your heart rate as high as you can and then practice. How quickly can I get my heart rate down, my state of arousal down, and then get it back up and then down, and down. What'll happen is you get tired, you'll notice the graph starts to start to narrow. You don't get as high, you don't get as low. And you may use that as a proxy for when to end your workouts. So if you're noticing, like, hey, in the first 5 sets, I can get this like 200 or 200 beats a minute, I'm like, I'm peaking out. And then after I've done that for 7 or 8 minutes, well, gosh, I'm only at 180 now. So now you're sort of into this like slightly overtrained, you're no longer adapting type state. So start with that without the molecules, because the molecules are helpful, but they're not going to teach you the state. They're sort of like bypassing the state, right? So, like, if you really want to become a peak performer, you don't take the molecules to bypass the state. You take the molecules, for example, if you're like, hey, I've got to compete today, I've got a game today, or I got a really big meeting that I can't screw up. Now I take the molecules because I know I'm just going to be dialed in, right? I don't want to use them in training because then you lose the training effect. Make sense?
Yes, sir. Yeah, sounds good.
So there's some, I'll say this, I know you're looking for some molecules and stuff. So alpha GPC is one that will universally help both states. Really, really useful product, really, really useful molecule. You could also put other things into that category, maybe like B vitamins and rhodiola and NuPEPT. Both of those can help. NuPEPT is a pretty strong nootropic that can help you get into both beta and alpha. So, if you want a protocol for that, I can certainly guide that path too. As far as methylene blue, I don't know how I would fit into those categories, if I'm honest. It's sort of just driving energy. What drive focus? Maybe. Depends on who's using it. So I know you specifically asked about that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah, man. Anyone else have questions come up while we were talking? Jake, see you? No. Okay, so let's assume that we've just, and so here's a simple takeaway. There's generally between five and six things that everyone should be taking every day, not should, can be taking every day to be in alignment with their genes and ultimately in line with their environment. And they're different for everybody. There's generally some simple supplements. It may be like for myself, for example, it's like magnesium, zinc, fish oils, curcumin, vitamin D, some version of that, right? Really basic stuff. And like most people would benefit from taking those because, we live in a more stressed environment than we would ever have evolutionarily. So your stress pathways are going to be driven. We're probably consuming more food than we would have evolutionarily. We've probably been fasting a lot more. The nutrients would have been much more, or the food would have been nutrient dense. So, like, there's some basic things that, and B vitamins would be another one for most people. I've yet to see anyone in the genetic test that isn't deficient in some B vitamin. So taking a methylated B vitamin is a good idea for most people. How many people have done their genes? Didn't do it yet, Jeff? Sorry. It's pretty useful, man. Like, I got 4 to 6 things that, and without being so sort of like, without hyperbole, sort of like life changing, because it's like the energy and the focus and the clarity that was unlocked for me consistently has been remarkable. Is a life changer. It's a game changer for me in my parenting, for sure. Understanding how my kids' genetics work is a game changer. That was awesome. All right, so without keeping you guys here too much longer, I just want to quickly touch on. So you've got your foundational things, right? These are the things that are ultimately going to bring you back into this homeostatic place and allow you to keep there as consistently as you can, so that every day is predictable, right? So the way to think of it is like you're bringing up the base. I don't want to have a base that's like sort of dumping into like, oh gosh, I feel like shit today. I can't even get out of bed. I don't have the energy to go do the basic life tasks. Nobody ever wants to go there. So you need to make sure your foundational training and nutrition, at very least, doesn't allow any more troughs, right? We can have the peaks, but no more troughs. So what does that look like? Well, whatever your limitation is, some people are limited by stress, some people are limited by obesity, some people are limited by energy. Find things that allow you to stay as a baseline without going into a trough. Then from there, everything after that is called situational. So we have foundational and situational. That's it, right? Situational means I'm working on something specific. Like Jeff said, hey man, I want my brain to be on fire. I'm like, great. So there's like, do the basic things first, which is the training and the nutrition and maybe the meditation. And then everything on top of that is icing on the cake. Do peptides work? Yes. Do they work the same for everybody? No. How do we try to make them as effective as possible? By doing the basic stuff really well, right? So if I know your training is dialed in, your nutrition is dialed in, your sleep is dialed in, like you may not even want the peptides. Man, I'm pretty good. I don't know that I have anything else that I want to have. Whereas people generally who are reaching for peptides aren't willing to do the work on the basic foundational lifestyle stuff. So again, when we get then into situational stuff, it's like, well, am I trying to fix sleep? Am I trying to fix stress? Am I working toward a specific goal? Those generally, how you think about situational, and those rotate. So no situational supplements are done in perpetuity, and they shouldn't be. So like, is there something wrong with methylene blue? No, it's great. Is there something wrong with NuPEPT? No, it's great. How often do you do it? Depends, right? So like, if you guys don't know what these are, just some like some brain sups. I'm a big fan of brain sups. Love them. I was sort of massively against them until 2017 when I decided to do a 12-month study on myself. And I think it rebuilt my brain, if I'm honest. It was pretty remarkable. So yeah, I'm not against brain subs at all. I just think they should be situational. Questions? When I say that I did a 12-month experiment on myself and it fixed my brain, most people go, "What's the protocol?" I can share. I did a lot of cool shit, actually.
What did you find you had a great benefit with the brain stuff?
So in typical, me fashion, it was never one thing. It was like I'm sort of an all-in. Like if I'm gonna do it, I'm like, all right, we're going all in. So I did a lot of things, and it's really hard to say, hey, this specific one did this enormous amount. But what I did do intentionally was I separated interventions according to class. So for example, I would never do two supplements at the same time. So I would do like aniracetam for 3 weeks, take a week off, and then I'd do oxiracetam for 3 weeks, take a week off, and then I'd do NuPEPT for 3 weeks, take a week off, and then I'd cycle through them again and see, did I get the same result twice? So I would look through these individual molecules and say, like, which one was getting the greatest benefit? And so the other things I would stack, I was doing like, well, there'd be meditation with a breath, with a brain app. There'd be meditation with breath work. So you look at all these different interventions. Then there was like brain training, like not neuro training, neurofeedback training. I did a lot of really interesting stuff. So I don't know if you guys know my story, but like I grew up in a pretty chaotic household. So there's a lot of stress. There's a lot of like terrible diet, terrible environment. So like I grew up with what I would have said is just a broken brain. So I was convinced. I was like, "Hey, man, I got to do something about this." So my approach was to go all in. And in fact, a very good friend of mine was the inspiration for it. His name is Matt Gallant. He's been on the podcast 2 or 3 times. One of the smartest guys I know, and he goes all in on brain health. Like he owns Bioptimizers, actually, the company Bioptimizers that I advocate for. He's a really, really switched on dude. But he's sort of the guy who's like all in. So I was using ketones. I was using off of GPC. Man, I would order off of GPC by the kilogram, and I would take a ton of it in the morning, ton of it in the evening, and it made a big difference. So like the guy who owns the patent was a friend, and he would send it to me like with explicit instructions on how to take it. What you got, Jake?
Interesting.
Yeah, tiger milk mushroom, is that kind of following with this nootropic idea? What are your thoughts
No,
on that?
I don't know, man. I suspect you got that from Chad, who got it from Keuchel, and Keuchel's trying to get me to do it. I'm like, I don't know how it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah, totally. Keuchel's the only one I know who likes to talk about that thing. It sounds. Listen, every mushroom is in some way, I think, useful. At least all the ones that are sort of medicinal, mainstream mushrooms. Is it going to be something miraculous about it? Not a
Really move the
chance.
needle much,
So.
who knows?
Well, so I'll tell you what. There's two guys in the, three guys in the world that are like mushroom authorities. Paul Stamets being one. The other two guys are from Vancouver, Canada. Jeff and Sky Chilton, and Jeff and Sky are very good friends, and I talk to them relatively often. And they were like, "Nah, there's nothing unique about it." I asked. It's like, "Nah, nothing unique about it. All mushrooms have value, but none. Not that I know about tiger milk being anything useful." I'd be curious what
Thanks.
Chad has to say about it.
Thanks.
Yeah, no problem. Matzah saying he likes NeuroPrime. That was mine too, man. That was one of my. I did the formulations, and I named it as well, which is not my favorite name, but growth factor. Yeah, which didn't make any sense, did it? That's why I changed the name. I'm like, why is it called growth factor? Anyone else got questions? Guys, you don't get every minute of the day to ask questions, man. If you guys have any, I'm here for you, man. Let's go.
Seriously.
If you guys want to wrap on.
I was a little interested in on at the beginning you were saying some people aren't capable to train hard, whether it's fear or whether it's something limiting you in a mindset type way. What would you have to say about that?
Well, identify the limiter and then remove it. So is
Yeah.
it so for some for many people it's physical. So the way to think of or the way I think of it, energy is generally most people's limiter. So there's only four things that can limit you. When it comes to like pushing to a new level, it's your physical body could be injured. Could be energy, right? So physical body could also mean like VO2 max. It could be energy, so you don't have enough energy production. I'll talk about that in a second. Could be stress. You don't have the ability to like I was saying to Jeff, like get up and get down, the arousal control. And fourth is your mindset. So, yeah, if someone's limited by energy, what that really means is the rate of energy production at the level of the mitochondria is too slow. Your body's not producing energy glycolytically, either alactic or lactic, very effectively. So we have to literally train that system. We can literally train the glycolytic energy system, which is this ability to produce energy really, really intensely in a short amount of time. So these bursts. So we have to train that system. And then, after say 60 seconds, then we're going to switch into an aerobic energy system. And then there's also a rate of energy production in the aerobic system. So most people that you would experience just don't have the ability to produce energy fast enough, long enough to actually work hard. Is there a mental component? Yes, but I think in my experience, they can do it mentally, they just don't do it mentally. So sort of nuanced. But I would say if you want to push harder, Mike, I would play the energy game and be like, hey, how can I push these specific energy systems longer and harder? Again, there's a point of diminishing returns. Like you don't need to become an endurance athlete, but like peak those energy systems. So you have, basically, well, there's four, but three that you can really train. So your alactic, your lactic, and your aerobic energy systems. Most people would know the aerobic through the term VO2 max. It's like how much can we actually produce here in the VO2 max? So we want to push those three systems. And so everyone that I work with, I'll push those three systems for the first 12 weeks to make sure you have the highest level of energy capability, which means you can train hard and you burn the most fat, calories.
Okay, yeah, that's great. Thank you.
And so if you want specifically around mindset, if you feel like you're fearful in mindset, I would play with the first thing I always do. I believe your mind will go. So the two-way street, right? Your body goes where your mind wants it to go, and your mind goes where your body wants it to go. They're inextricably linked. The one that tends to work more for me is I'll try to get people fired up, like I was saying to Jeff. Like, how can we just get your body so fired up that your brain goes there? And what will generally happen is most people will end up in fear. So why don't people push their body really hard? They're afraid they're going to pass out. They're afraid they're going to die. You push them there, and you let them become more and more familiar with it over time. So in the beginning, you're like, fuck it. Like, I always use the proverbial fire as the example. So imagine the first time humans ever saw fire way off in the distance. They're like, oh my goodness, it's a god. Great. Then the next time they went closer, they're like, oh my goodness, it's a god. Eventually they went closer, like, oh, this is my friend, and I can warm my family and cook my food. So I think it's exercise is not dissimilar. It's like in the beginning, they're like, oh my gosh, I don't want to go anywhere near it. You do it often enough, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, I realize this is my best friend. I want to move in toward this discomfort, not away from it.
Yeah, that makes good sense.
Yeah, train
Hey
it.
Ben, would you say SLUPP and BAM helps with that performance energy or like as a pre-workout?
Less BAM, more SLUPP. Not so much BAM. I don't think that's going to help you with energy production necessarily. Maybe a little bit, but it's more of like an uncoupler. It may help with fat loss, but SLUPP I think would be a really good one to push more energy through the system.
For a
But like,
workout,
so
or
the way to think of it, Jake, is it's such a small lever. Like, if you're not doing the training for it,
Yeah.
you're just literally pissing away from the training. Yeah.
Okay. There.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Robert, I haven't heard from you today, man. What you got?
Things running through my head. One was about, I've had this sort of thought, you know, some of the ones you get into the supplementation side, particularly around some of the growth hormone and testosterone and others, you know, our body naturally starts to decrease in testosterone as we get older.
It actually
And
doesn't. That was refuted.
really?
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't. So if your cells start to lose capability because of bad aging, then testosterone goes down. Testosterone doesn't go down naturally. There's guys in mid to late 90s who just have the same testosterone they did in the 20s.
Yeah, cool. Look, and I mean, it's something that I've never gone down that path. I've now had the genetic testing done and others, and there's no problem there for me. So it's not, I'm not abnormally high, I'm not abnormally low. And I've always worried a little bit, like, is there a problem with, I guess, using the car analogy again, revving the engine too hard, not through natural training, but with some of the supplementation that people get into. You know, I saw a guy in the gym this morning and I was like, man, he is clearly like heavily anabolic. Is there the downside there long term? If he's going to be putting too much stress through his heart, is this going to catch up with him when he's 70, 80? Like, and I want to have that balance of I want to be strong. I'd love some more muscle mass, but I also don't want to jeopardize, you know, keeling over and not being with my kids in 30 years' time.
Yeah. So, man, there's a lot to unpack there. There's like, so someone who's like very obviously, like if you can see they're taking hormones, they're probably taking a lot more than therapeutic testosterone replacement. That's a different game. You know, I played that game for 10 years, man. So like, very familiar with that game. And is it going to potentially shorten your life if you're doing things stupidly? 1,000%, because you're going to throw off your cholesterol, you're going to throw off your oxidative stress, like. You're gonna do a lot of damage, man. I know I did a lot of damage. So, you know, that's sort of why my pendulum sort of swung in the other direction to like, how do I heal myself as quickly as possible, as much as possible? So specifically your question is, it sounds like you're curious, like, hey, should I do this? Is this a good idea, bad idea?
Yeah, I guess the way I try to rationalize it in my head is I sometimes think about, you know, like you see a overweight middle-aged man, but he's spent thousands of extra dollars on a road bike that's 100 grams lighter. And I think, man, you're like, you've got 10 kilos you could lose before you had to spend that money. And for me, I think like there's always the allure there of maybe there's a pill, maybe there's a supplement. And I go, at the end of the day, like until I'm maxing out my workout, my sleep, my nutrition, and I think you said it just before, like you're tweaking around the edges sometimes. But I think
Yeah.
there's that natural instinct to be like, but I would love a quick fix if it was there. And I always just have to keep talking myself out of it, going, man, just get up and go to the gym. That's the first step. And then and eat well and like
Yeah. So the question I always ask is why? So if you're like, hey, I want to take this thing, why? And you're like, well, because, I want to accelerate fat loss. Well, what? Or I want to build more muscle. Like, okay, well, why do you want to build more muscle? Well, because, I'd like the way it looks. Well, why would you like the way it looks? Well, because, I want more confidence. And like, so if you get down like the 3 to 5 layers deep and ask why, it's usually some version of like, well, I want to feel better about myself. And like the truth of the matter is the supplement won't make you feel better about yourself, but the work you put in will make you feel better about yourself, So like intentionally choosing the obstacle and the obstacle is the way mindset, that's the thing that will actually make you feel better about yourself, knowing you're the type of person who did the work. Pulling the lever to get the end result doesn't build the character, does it? It's like, well, I got the result. That's why, and that's the problem with social media. You have all these monkeys who literally haven't accomplished anything, took a bunch of drugs, they look really awesome. Now they're getting all these accolades and they don't understand humility. They don't understand work. They don't understand character. They're just sort of given the prize without the work. You're like, oh, that's not very becoming. And you can always tell when somebody's made success through hard work and putting in the time and effort versus somebody who's sort of handed something. You're like, there's a lot of entitlement there. So I personally would be like, well, I want to put in the work, and if I'm still putting in the work and I want to take something else, great. But the work is the way, man.
Yeah, awesome. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
I've got two questions, Ben.
John, fire away. I'm listening.
And it kind of stems from, I was listening to a podcast of Jay Ferrugia last week. Matt knows that when I joined, it was because my testosterone was like 33 total. And so I joined the testosterone program to see what I could do naturally to raise it. We were able to triple it, but it was still not enough to be like an acceptable level. So I started working with injections through my primary care physician in May. And so they have me on one injection a week. And Jay talks about that he feels like microdosing rather than taking one dose every one shot every 1 to 2 times a week is the way to go.
Yeah.
So I wanted your thoughts on that. And the second thing he said was he said that when someone's natural body temperature is low, and mine falls somewhere around 97.1, 97.3, that it affects the testosterone and you need to work on getting the body temperature up. So that's the first time I ever heard that. So I'm kind of curious on your take.
Yes to the first one. More frequent administrations is better. I think the second one's bullshit. But if your body temperature is naturally low, I would look at your thyroid, right? So like if your thyroid is low, that could make your testosterone low. That's true. But body temperature being low is in no way, again, in my mind, ever going to impact testosterone being low. It might even be the opposite. It sort of depends. So why is your temperature low? What would you have to do to increase it? Is it about movement? Is it about blood flow? Is it microvascular capillarization? Like what is the reason why it's low? Usually the answer is probably thyroid. So I don't know. I don't know. I would say that I don't think there's a direct correlation between the body temperature being low and testosterone, but there may be some other reason.
But that did seem crazy to me. That's why I asked.
Yeah, it's a bit... far-fetched. It could be accurate, but there's a bunch of missing pieces in the middle that I would have to explore, John. I would say like check your thyroid for sure. So when you say your body temperature is low, is that like in your hands, in your mouth, in your rectum? Like where are they trying? Where are they testing this?
When I do it in my mouth, it's usually when I'm above 97.3.
I don't think it's, I would go right to your vascular, your microvascular capillarization. Like, is there just low blood flow to your hands, to your feet and to your mouth because of maybe you're not getting enough cardio or something, like you're not enough, vasculature there. Like, I don't think body temperature measured anywhere specifically means anything. Have you measured your thyroid?
I'll ask Greg. I talked to him tomorrow.
Yeah, Greg will know. Yeah, I wouldn't draw so many conclusions before looking deeper. Gents, I know we're a few minutes late here. Anything else you guys want to do? Anything else you guys want to wrap on before we let you guys go? John, I would try putting up put some iodine, put like 3 drops of iodine in your water before bed.
Okay.
Lugol's iodine, Lugol, Lugol's iodine, 3 drops, tiny amount in your water before bed every day. Talk to Greg about it, and I would do
Okay.
that.
Okay.
Jeff,
Thanks.
thank you, man. John, thank you. Jake, thank you.
Hey,
Mike,
thanks, Ben.
thanks,
Good to
buddy.
meet
Take
you.
care.
Appreciate everything. Yep.
Welcome to the community, man. Welcome to the team. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Totally stoked. Where are you going?